Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF. Hey, folks, last year I took control of my eating habits and I built a better routine for myself. Now I feel much healthier and just better overall. But one thing I know is my way might not be your way. That's what's great about Noom. Noom builds individualized weight management plans that meet your personal needs. And they've got a great app so you can see your goals clearly. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck Nicks? What the fuckadelics? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. Have a seat. Have a run. Have a drive. Do your work. Do some knitting. Do some riveting. Do some engine work. Is there anyone out there working on an engine? Yeah, I don't know what people do. You get obsessed. You focus. And you get into it. I'm that way. I've done that with many things. The weird thing about that is that when you get involved with either amassing or working on one thing compulsively, I've done it with some minor woodworking. I've done it with collecting records. I've done it with a recipe. But the weird thing about having that compulsion, a sort of singular focus that you just can't get out of your head and that you have to do, is that once you do it, You hit a wall with it. You know, whether it's being a completist in terms of like, I got to have all the records by that guy, or it's getting a recipe adjusted just right, or maybe building or rebuilding engines or a guitar, whatever it is. I mean, I guess some people, it becomes their life. But for me, like, I'll get into it and I'll work it and I'll work it. And then like when I'm sort of, I've done all I can, it goes away, and then it's just a memory. There you go. You know how to make that thing exactly how you wanted to make it. You now have all those records by that guy. There you go. I imagine engines are different, especially if it's a singular focus, where it's like one car that you love, and you just keep doing it. And then some things, for me, like eventually they just, you know, I'll break them, or they just don't come out the way I want. And then there's that reminder. I've done that with stuff, me and my big ideas. Don't go on YouTube to figure out how to get the red shoe polish that some guy at the airport got on the nice heels of your Brian the Bootmaker boots because he polished the goddamn soles on the sides. You can't sand that off. You can't sand rubber. You can't just use alcohol to get it out. It's fucked until it naturally wears off. And either you just say, fuck these boots, or you say, well, this is the way they are now. This is the life these boots are living. I don't know if that makes sense to anybody or whether you're making a cake for the fourth time, but I don't know. Just some thoughts I had in the moment. Okay, look, today on the show, Jimmy Carr is here. Jimmy Carr, he's a British-Irish comedian and actor. He's been a host of several panel shows in Britain, and he's now set to release his fourth Netflix special this week. And look, I've known about Jimmy Carr forever. Man, it goes back to a bad time in my life, actually, if I'm to be honest with you. The first time I went to Edinburgh, not in great shape mentally, emotionally, just in the beginning of a separation with my second wife. That was devastating. But I was booked there, and I was on a double bill with Kirk Fox. Many of you have heard bits and pieces of this conversation, of this story, but it was horrendous. I don't love going to other countries for a long time, and here I was signed up to do a month, 3 weeks or whatever, in Scotland, and it's not like there's no language barrier. I don't know if that's completely true, but there is a slight language barrier in terms of trying to get acclimated to the spectrum of Scottish accents. But what do I remember about that trip? I just was miserable, and Kirk and I were not drawing crowds, and I met Jimmy there. I met him for the first time with Morgan Murphy, and I knew he was a big act, and I knew he did primarily one-liners of the dark variety. That was sort of his thing. He was sort of almost a ghoulish Bob Hope. And I could tell he was a pro, that's for sure. He definitely had a huge following. He definitely had his craft in place. I've always been impressed with guys who can do jokes, like just jokes for an hour. It's kind of amazing to remember that you haven't done a one-liner. And he struck me as an okay guy, and I wanted to get him on the podcast. But he never, I don't know if he didn't want to do it. I got the sense that he didn't want to share on that level. But whatever's happened in his life, he now does. And he's now here. You know, it's weird. I remember, it's just coming back to me. It must have been in August. Because to keep my sanity, I went to a small AA meeting in Edinburgh, like every day I was there, or at least every other day. And I became fairly close with that group. And this is just a testament to the sort of community. And how sober was I? Well, I was already like probably six or 7 years sober at that point. But I do remember going to this meeting and being, you know, kind of like taken care of in a way, because I was emotionally distraught and I was in another country. And I remember, I think I had an anniversary, a sober anniversary while I was there. And I remember they gave me like this little kind of like stone, polished stone elephant. And I have it. And it meant a lot to me, with a little card. And it's just a testament to the support available to you if you want it, even if you don't want to work a program or anything else. If you're in a pinch and you're feeling squirrely, you can usually just show up at one of those things, and whether you like it or not, feel better. But I am grateful to that fellowship in Scotland for that experience. That's for sure. It definitely helped me. Tonight, I'm in Austin, Texas at the Paramount Theater as part of the Moon Tower Comedy Festival. I'll be in Montclair, New Jersey on Thursday, May 2nd at the Wellmont Center. Glenside, Pennsylvania near Philly on Friday, May 3rd at the Keswick Theater. Washington, D.C. on Saturday, May 4th at the Warner Theater. Munhall, Pennsylvania outside Pittsburgh on May 9th at the Carnegie Library Music Hall. Cleveland, Ohio on May 10th at the Playhouse Square. Detroit, Michigan on May 11th at the Royal Oak Music Theater. Go to WTFpod.com/tour for all my dates and links to tickets. You can do it. You can do it. Come on out. I saw the movie Civil War, and I did not know what to expect, and I don't know what you're expecting. I don't know if you're, I talk to a lot of people, and they're like, I don't want to go, because many people feel that on some level. Even if polls are correct, many people feel we're on the verge of a civil war with a very specific line, you know, between the two ideologies. The political division in this country is profound. And I think most of us, you know, it's gotten to the point where, like, I was in the Midwest, you walk down the street and you're walking by people, and in your brain, you're both thinking, probably for different reasons, I bet he's one. I bet they're one. And that's not good. It's not good, but it's hard to get past. And I wish we could get past it. But heading into the Civil War, you want to think that, okay, well, this is going to be a depiction of the possibilities of what civil war would look like in America. And perhaps it is, but there is no teams, really. There's no ideological motives that you can really attach yourself to. I don't want to spoil anything. I don't know if it's possible, but you know, the president, who is played by Nick Offerman in a small but powerful part, has all we really know about the president, and he's gotten rid of the FBI, and he's taken a third term for himself. So that's not right. But then there's like these different sort of armies or militias or forces. There's the Texas-California Alliance, which is odd, but intentionally, because those two states really represent the division in our country right now. But in this movie, you don't go into it, but they are aligned, and there's the Florida military or whatever, and then there's a quick mention of something up in the Pacific Northwest that might be Maoist. So that's all you really get, though. In terms of the actual fights and bloody combat, you don't know who's fighting who. All you know is that they're Americans, which is a very interesting way to portray this. You follow this crew of press people, photographers, and one aging journalist. But at any given point where they're seeing combat or seeing carnage, you don't know who did it or why. Even in the battles, you're not sure who's against who. All you know is they are Americans fighting Americans and killing them. And in each situation, you sort of are kind of shown the humanity or lack of humanity in all of these situations, whether they be the shooters or whether they be, you know, people, refugees, or whether they be, you know, bystanders. But what's really interesting about the movie is not really knowing whose side is what side is what anybody stands for. There's hints at it, and you do know that they're gunning for the president. But in terms of ideologically, it's vague. I know that's sort of hard to wrap your brain around and even hard to see how that would work, but it does work. And there's definitely moments that are taken from even the Congo. You know, just how do regular people, and even the American Civil War, how do neighbors kill neighbors? How do relatives kill relatives? It's in there. So if you're expecting either, you know, if you're a progressive and you're expecting some apocalyptic vision with identifiable sides that sort of, you know, make your nightmare come true, that's not really what it is. If you're a right-wing sociopath, you might have a couple moments, but it's not really what it's about. These teams are not really represented. What's represented is war, and what's represented is Americans at war with themselves. And it's really a study of the humanity and lack thereof of war. And I thought it was compelling, and I thought it was a good film. And I would recommend it. How's that? How's that for you? Go see it. Don't be afraid of it. All right, look, Jimmy Carr is here, and I did not know him, and I did not think I would ever get to know him. I did not think that, you know, he would be willing to talk, but it was good. It was good to talk to him, and smart guy, funny guy. His special, Jimmy Carr, Natural Born Killer, is out on Netflix starting tomorrow, April 16th, and this is me and Jimmy. Sometimes I wish I paid more attention in school, or in some cases, any attention at all. There are probably a lot of things I could have gotten more out of, like literature, and now it's probably not in the cards to go back to school and study the classics. But luckily for us, there's a new podcast called The Foxed Page that dives deep into the best books of all time. This is basically like the best possible college English class, but more relaxed and fun. No pressure of grades or needing to prepare something to say in class. It's only the books you want to read and know about, presented by best-selling author Kimberly Ford. Everything from Cormac McCarthy to Madame Bovary, from classics like Frankenstein to modern hits like Lessons in Chemistry. I love Ireland, but I missed the boat on James Joyce. The Foxed Page has a three-part series on Dubliners, and that's a pretty great starting point. Want to get the most out of what you read? The Foxed Page is for you. Get it now wherever you get your podcasts. Yeah, Carnegie, I played there, and it felt like a lot of there was a weight to it.
Hmm.
It didn't. It felt like it was a privilege and an honor, even though they book anyone there now.
Well, as evidenced. but it's that weird thing, though, those places that I saw Barry Manilow the other night.
At Carnegie?
No, I was in Vegas.
Oh.
And he was talking about when he played, he knew he'd made it when his grandfather came to, oh, his father came to see him in Carnegie Hall.
Yeah.
I thought, I've played there. It just seemed otherworldly to me. The idea of these, there's certain places that have that, and we get to go in there and do our thing, and it's so recent, man. It's
history.
Well, but it only goes back. I mean, I know you can trace comedy back to the trickster gods of prehistory, but I think it's Carlin and Pryor.
Yeah.
And this is the newest medium, right? So like, you think, what's America given the world, right? Jazz, amazing.
Yeah, sure.
Westerns.
Yeah.
And stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
And stand-up comedy so in its infancy. Yeah. The fact that we get to do it now is like you've been in it almost as long as comedy's been going.
I think so. It's sort of
how many years in are you? 35?
You can look at rock and roll the same way. That was 57, right? In 57, rock and roll happens. And I believe...
It's incredible, isn't it?
It's wild.
I
believe
think about that
the
thing
closer to the source you are, the better, on some level, the connection you have to the source. Like, there are the bands that we grew up with that were one generation away.
Well, the 70s, the thing that blows my mind about the 70s, people talk about, I ain't in music now, and they, you know, kids love what they love, right?
Yeah, sure.
But the 70s, like, every 18 months, I mean, I was a baby, but every 18 months, there was something new.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, reggae just happened. Not a new band.
Yeah.
Reggae just happened. And then ska and Trojan happened.
Big.
And you went, that's a different genre.
Totally.
And then...
I wonder about comedy.
And then krautrock happened.
Yeah, like, krautrock, yeah.
It's like a different genre every 18 months.
You
with
really
comedy,
think,
is
you think
any...
that modern stand-up is really that young?
I really do, yeah. And I think it's like...
So who do you
like
think
people
it starts
don't remember.
With?
I think it starts with... I think... Okay, obviously there's Lenny Bruce sort of beforehand, right?
Mort Saul, Shelley Berman,
I mean,
early
incredible.
Cosby.
All of those. Yeah. I've got all of those kind of original vinyl albums.
Yeah, me too,
amazing.
Right.
But I think... That was nightclub comedy. It was a slightly different thing. I think like people on stage, it would have been like Billy Connolly in the UK or Jasper Carrot. Guys filling an auditorium and doing like an hour and people have just paid to see them. It's almost like someone told me a thing about, I think it was Deep Purple at the Hammersmith Apollo was the first ever band that didn't play on a bill.
Oh, really?
The Beatles always played on a bill. There was always like other people. Well, we're going to have a juggler and
some
trapeze artists, and then we'll have a singer and we'll have someone to do ballads. And
they
then you
that,
come on.
They did that in England with the variety show stuff?
All the variety shows.
Yeah.
Everything was a variety show until that point. So that thing of like modern stand-up.
1962? 1960?
That went to like 69. Everything was, I think it was 69 is like...
Because Bill Graham did it out here, but it wasn't even with the rock thing. I mean, he was trying to integrate... the new rock bands of the 60s with the old blues artists and folk artists. So he did not a variety show, but he tried to mix it up.
Yeah.
But you're saying that stand-up isolated as an art form
I think is,
in a big room is new.
I think pretty new. I mean, listen, there's no first.
Steve Martin.
There's never a first. Okay, so Steve Martin's the first ever
arena
guy. And then it's Eddie Murphy.
Yeah.
And Eddie Murphy's such a weird quirk of stand-up because no one else came out fully formed.
Yeah.
It's never happened before. It may never happen again.
Bob Newhart was pretty fully formed.
But he was a much older guy.
Okay.
He'd lived a life.
But yeah, kind of. It was a very odd story about him. It was radio. He started in radio. And when he recorded that first album, it was really the first time.
Was that the button-down comedian?
Yeah, it was like the first or second time he'd ever done it as a set. It's crazy. The Newhart story is crazy.
I never knew that. I've got the records. I've never really.
Yeah, he was doing radio bits. And he put them together. I interviewed him. And it was really, he had never done stand-up before. Like those nights, almost.
Wow.
It's crazy.
I spoke to someone that saw him. I'm just trying to think who it was. Some comic I knew like, paid and went to see him. They kind of pay homage.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, and he got a really lovely reception, very old audience. And it was, you know, one of his last shows. And and went, oh, he's kind of doing old bits. And it took him 20 minutes to this is where it's from.
That's right. Yeah,
this is
this
is the source.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like someone seeing the original.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, this is where they got it from. This is the Robert Johnson record that everything's based on.
This is
hearing Packer Bell's Canon and going, oh, that's where indie rock got melody from.
It's sort of interesting, right?
So I think comedy's in the infancy. I think this is new.
I'd like to believe that. And I guess just like, you know, rock and roll, it seems like any idiot can do it.
Can they? Neil Brennan made a really interesting point last year.
Really?
No, maybe 2 years ago.
He's good at making points now.
He is, yeah. He's, oh, God, I love Neil. Anyway, he was at Montreal.
Yeah.
He did like a State of the Union type talk. And he went, look, there's 60,000 brain surgeons in the world.
Yeah.
There's how many guys you would trust to do a special? Maybe 300 people that could do a good special? Good
a
hour?
Good special.
A good special.
But, you know, it does. That's not stopping anybody. That's my point. That's my point. I didn't say that there's, you know, anybody can do comedy well, you know, but with the advent of new platforms.
The bar feels low for comedy and then is extraordinarily high because it looks very easy. You're standing there with a microphone. There's no barrier to entry. You don't need equipment. And it looks like it might be an easy thing to do.
I think it's generational. I think people of the new generation just want to see, you know, kids their own age do funny shit. They don't have a context. There's no context anymore. So however we paid our dues or whatever mythology we put together for ourselves to justify our existence as professional comics means fucking nothing to them.
Well, but you pay your dues now or later. They, you know,
or you quit.
Anyone could be huge on the back of a TikTok thing, but will it last?
Is it going to be
a long career, right?
But sometimes you see, you know, these young comics and they're posting their first bits on TikTok. I'm like, what are you doing? You're going to be embarrassed.
Yeah, you're not ready yet.
But you're going to look back on this and be like, why the fuck did I put that up there? You can't take it back.
I don't know what we're going to do. What are we going to do with politicians in 30 years' time? We're just going to have to live with politicians where we've seen a dick pic.
Well, I guess. I mean, I don't know what we're doing with them now. It doesn't seem like anybody with any real civic concern wants the job anymore. So I have no idea.
It's a very weird thing. I heard something recently, though. I was like, listening to this thing, and then we're talking about America and sort of how America's – it's in a perfect spot.
Yeah. For what?
Well, it can afford to have a political system this fucked,
yeah,
because it is so blessed geographically. And
well, you know, that's the big hope that because it's a federalist union and that every state has states' rights, but it doesn't mean like crazy fuckers can't just take over every state, does it?
I think it might just be okay.
Maybe
I'm very optimistic.
I think that's all anyone's looking for. If we can just be okay.
Yeah,
we'll get through it. But who the fuck knows, dude?
Well, I think things are getting better. I quite like that Steven Pinker thing.
I think things are getting better?
I'm very optimistic. I mean, by every metric, things are getting better, right? Getting worse?
Well, I mean, I hear that. I mean, I understand there are some things getting worse. I think a lot of people's brains are a little soft and a little undisciplined. So whatever is getting better.
But there's always like two things going on. So there's that thing of like people's attention spans now are really short and they're looking at TikTok and 4-second videos, but also very long. People will watch 60 hours of Game of Thrones.
Joe Rogan
or Breaking
Show. One Joe Rogan podcast.
Yeah, but that long form thing is...
My concern is how easily led and how easily, you know, brain fucked people are. But I guess it's always been that way. But whatever advances we've made in technology has made it very efficient.
Yes, the brain fuckery is faster.
Much faster.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm doing a bit now about, I don't know what's faster. What makes people crazy faster? You know, Facebook or crystal meth? And it's tight. You know, it's
neck and neck.
And it's neck and neck.
But you know, wrote the there's a great book about this. Neil Postman wrote this book in 1984.
We are amusing ourselves to death. I've read that
book.
It's
so great,
a great book. But everything he's prophesied, I mean, that was, yeah, he called it.
He called everything. Change anything.
Yeah, but now, like, you're talking about politicians, and now that is how people judge them, is how amusing they are. Like,
Trump is a
clown. He's one of the great evil buffoons.
He's an insult comic.
He's a wrestling heel.
Yeah. But that thing of like going, Aldous Huxley was kind of right. Cheap dopamine hits is what we're giving away our freedom for.
So sure. It's this idea and you can hold it in your hand and you don't have to take anything.
Well, the lovely thing about stand-up is it feels like it's in real life. You sort of do it, you stand up in front of other people.
For us, it does.
It's tribal. It's brilliant. Well, it's that thing where you go, so much of life is a proxy. Because we've done this thing to kids where we've sort of helicoptered parented and kept them so safe.
Right.
So the only freedom they got was online. So
we did that.
I think that this, like, our generation.
Well, the idea of just giving the kid an iPad. Everyone surrenders to it. What about your kids? How old are your kids?
My kids are 4 and 2.
Did you give them an iPad?
No.
No.
They were like a little bit of TV.
No, but I mean, give them a phone. Are they looking at the phone? Are they pushing buttons?
They're not allowed the phone.
No buttons yet?
No buttons.
No buttons, no screens?
Little tiny bit of screen, tiny bit of TV, you know, kids thing, but like very,
four
very
seems like four seems like first iPad, iPad time, no? Four?
I don't think so. I think like I watched that thing on, what was it called? The Social Network or something? On yeah. It was on Netflix and it was kind of all the guys that started those companies go, oh no, you can't give those to your children.
Right.
No. God, no. No, this is, no, don't take the poison. It's like the Sackler family going, right. no, don't take it. I don't care if you're in pain.
Well, let's talk about this idea of politicians and the idea of things getting better. And like, you know, obviously right now is a good time for comedy. And in some of the stuff that is getting better is our ability to find our audience. If you have the goods,
well,
you can usually find your
people.
You've
got the famous, isn't that the fact about you? You sell more single tickets than any other comedian. No,
that's a joke I used to do.
Is that true? I heard that was true, which I kind of take as a point of honor.
Yeah, well, I mean, I used to do a bit about that because there'd just be these sad. I could tell who they were. You know, these sad guys that would come, like they, but they would they. It was the idea was that like they couldn't get anyone to go with them. That was the idea.
But so it's a weird thing of like, I don't know if you ever do this, but you look out in your audience and you go, who needs this? Who needs it? Like you get chatting to someone in the audience.
My audience definitely needs it.
Yeah, I think you need it too. I think that thing about what you do on stage, what you bring, I think I do in a very different way.
Yeah.
But it's that need for affirmation, the idea that comedy's not the healthiest because the locus of control is outside of you. You need the audience to like you.
Yeah, I don't know if I like. I've thought about that a lot in terms of why I do it because I'm not one of these guys who loves to be loved necessarily. Well, I like to have them fight for it, but I do feel that if I have a point of view on something, I would like to see if it's a common experience. And over time, I realize that I, even though I think I have broad appeal, it's fairly specific, what I do, but it is validated by the people that like what I do. So I'm not looking for love, but I am looking to be understood. And if I am understood, I think I'm helping those people that understand me.
A friend of mine said something, the singer Robbie Williams, British singer?
Yeah.
World famous in Europe.
Yeah.
He's very good. But he said this thing, it was quite heartbreaking. He said, I'm an entertainer in the old-fashioned sense. If you don't love me, I don't love me. And I think stand-up comedians, I think we both have a thing where we desperately need to be loved, but totally on our own terms.
I'm not going to love me either way, but I appreciate the sentiment.
Yeah. I mean, it's a weird thing. It's like, I don't know where that comes from. Are you still in therapy? Are you still doing a lot of therapy?
No, I never did a lot of therapy. I've gone to therapy at different times of my life. I'm pretty aware of who I am. And I don't ever think I have a real problem with people that characterize comedy as some sort of therapy for the comedian. Because I don't really think that's the deal. And I do fairly personal stuff, but this is my point of view. And this is how I see people through my experience. So if I'm going to share that experience and it is a common experience with the people that come, then we're all good. But I know what my problems are. I don't need to go into therapy to reassess them. I know what they are. And some of them have gotten better. How about you?
Not doing a lot of therapy.
Did you ever?
Yeah, I did quite a lot of stuff, but lots of kind of CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. And
what is it? What is that?
It's like thought patterns.
Well, I know what cognitive behavior therapy is. That's basically don't do that and you remember not to do it.
Yeah, a little bit of that. Lots of NLP as well. Lots of stuff that was kind of.
What is that?
Neuro-linguistic programming.
Yeah, I've never heard of that. What is that?
It's very kind of, it's very similar actually. It's a lot of the stuff from
cognitive therapy?
Cognitive behavioral therapy. So it's kind of going, look, the map is not the territory. What you imagine the world to be, your perception of the world is everything.
Right.
And changing your perception is easier than changing the world. So it's that kind of thing of going, look, disposition is more important than position. And changing your disposition is, changing the world is very difficult. Well, changing your disposition is a bit easier.
Well, that's interesting because that's a slippery slope to being brain fucked. Right?
Like,
if your perception is all there is, that's where you get into that weird place of like, what is a fact? Well,
yes.
It's something I believe because it makes me feel like it's right.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not quite.
No, I'm not saying
there, but yeah. Yeah.
But you're saying it's a practical approach to adjusting your perception so it's not all falling down on you.
Yeah. So if you have a problem
that
you need to kind of change the way that you think about that rather than thinking about, I don't like that thing. I don't want to feel uncomfortable. You go, well, actually reframing it is often a very valuable thing. So if you kind of, if you go into life kind of thinking, well, pressure is a privilege, right? So if you have that as a kind of mantra and you go, okay, this is going to be a difficult thing, but I'm excited about it. or you could say I'm terrified.
Right.
And it really makes a difference to how the gig goes.
Where does This Is Gonna Suck fall in?
This Is Gonna Suck happens.
Yeah. But that's not terrified or excited. It's more slightly diminishing. So if it's even a little better than that, it's good.
Well, I slightly believe happiness. There's a couple of definitions of happiness that I work with. And one is, right, it's expectations exceeded, right? Why is your birthday is awful? Birthdays are always the worst because it's meant to be the best night. And it's, it's fine. Yeah, your friends came and it was nice.
Yeah.
New Year's is like awful.
Terrible.
It's like, it's the worst.
I just don't do anything though. Do you?
No. But it's a night for amateur drinkers, which seems like.
Even birthday. My last birthday was good. 60 was good. Good friends.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
But that thing of like going, sometimes a random Tuesday night in a club or a show where you kind of go, it's not the biggest. Actually, before we started recording, talking about you play the big room with a big reputation.
Yeah.
Great. But sometimes when you just play the little place in the small town and the crowd are there for you, it's just amazing. And it's kind of, it blows your mind.
Yeah. For me, if I can get out of myself and find the stuff, if things happen, that's when it really happens. Like usually my best shows.
You find it on stage.
I do.
I find that terrifying as an idea.
But to me, that's like just the way, because lately it amazes me because if I do that, like if I have a premise already getting laughs, but it's not full yet, you know, if it's going to fill itself out, is the moment it happens, I don't know where that comes from. It's fucking magic. You know, it's like it just comes out of the ether because I've put myself in a position where I have to be funny. And I'm that way anyways, but I don't know where it's going to go. And if I have the freedom of mind and something comes, I'm like, wow, that was great.
But is that like it's almost like you're gaming the flow state of stand-up comedy. You're going, okay, I'm going to back myself into a corner.
That's it.
In front of 200 people in a club.
Right.
And they've all come and paid to see me and given up their evening.
Yes.
And I got nothing. I got two lines on a bit of paper and I don't know where this is going.
No, I'll at least have premises that are getting laughs.
Okay.
But I know that they're going to evolve. Right. So, but that's I'm not going to go up there and just like have nothing. I don't do that.
Right. But you've got the beginning of the idea.
Sure. I've got enough of the idea to where it's funny. And then I just I wait for it to fill in over a few months.
Yeah.
It's great. You put it all on paper. You're like mathematician.
I like much less alchemy, much more science in terms of like.
Well, you can tell that's your style.
Yeah. I mean, I think it chose me though. Cause when I started out, like I was obviously, I'm watching like Stephen Wright and Emo Phillips and Rita Rudner and gag to gag comics.
But you're a joke guy. Yeah.
I'm a joke guy, but I'm trying to move with the last special. I tried to do a couple of much longer bits.
I noticed that.
And I'm trying to do a much longer bit now in the new tour. Where I'm just trying to work a different muscle. I've got a fastball, and I respect the fact people come and see me, and it's a service industry, right? Someone's paid their money to come and see a show. I'm going to deliver. It's going to be edgy one-liners for as many as you need. And then I want to be able to surprise them a little bit and move it a little bit and get better as a performer.
I watched a special last night, and I noticed there were a couple bits where you were making points, where you had the gags, but they were of a piece. You know, that you were trying to, a longer piece. All the jokes were there, but you were still trying to make certain points that were a little longer than you usually do.
Yeah, I think I'm trying to grow as a performer. I'm just trying to get a little bit better, trying to get outside my comfort zone. I think that thing of like being outside your comfort zone is a very good
idea.
But
I think also just not outside your comfort zone, but you are, you know, if your point of view is just doing, you know, edgy one-liners, I mean, you can do whatever you want. I mean, if that's your style. But if at some point you want to engage a point of view,
it's a different thing.
It is a different thing.
And you know what I've really enjoyed? Like the last couple of years, right? I wrote a book a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
A kind of biography, but it was a bit self-helpy. It was like all the stuff that had helped me. Kind of a, you know, I'm into all that. I read all those books and I really like the idea of
really?
Like, yeah, that's my kind of thing of like, that's what got me out of my 9-to-5 was all of those kind of Eckhart Tolle things of like, this is it. Uh-huh. I had a, you know, an experience with grief where I kind of got a theory on grief where it's like, it's grief is cumulative, right? So in life, yeah. So my dog passed away recently, and I was just in a puddle. I just couldn't.
It's the worst.
It's just awful, and it's because partly it links to everyone you've lost, and partly it's about your own mortality and that idea of like, yeah, that old. I think it's Confucius. Every man's got two lives, and his second begins when he realizes he only has one.
Yeah.
Right? And you go, okay, it's kind of a hack thing. You could have that on a pincushion and sell it on Etsy.
Or you could twist it into really, a joke.
It really hit me. You know, that thing of like, oh, this is, you just do this now.
loss.
Yeah.
It reframes, like, outside of the lingual, what is that, CP what?
Neuro-linguistic programming, yeah.
NLP?
Yeah, that's it.
Outside of NLP, you know, what grief does is it emotionally, and maybe not spiritually, but it shifts your perception of how fragile life is. You know, it's not, and there's no way around it. You know, there's that moment where you realize if someone you love or something you love gets lost or dies, that, you know, it creates a hole. I don't know if you want to say soul, but it wakes up that part of you that makes you very present and very sad, but also you realize, like, well, this is going to happen.
And the highest agency people I think I've ever come across are the dying. Like, if you meet someone that's got 6 months to live or a year or whatever, they know they've got stage four and it's like, okay, this is it. Oh my God, their tolerance for bullshit is gone.
Why would you have it?
But also, we're all dying. It's the brief, what's that lovely line about? It's a brief sliver of light between two oceans of darkness.
Yeah.
This idea that before we were born, after we're dead, it's like this little, we get to die and we're the lucky ones.
So now what, are you like constantly scrambling to were you depressed? What compelled you, you know, to become this person, to put this puzzle together in so many different ways?
I got... I suffered a tiny bit with depression, not much.
And but what was the cathartic shift?
Anxiety was a huge thing for me, a huge problem with anxiety.
When you were younger? Before comedy?
No, kind of the last maybe, in comedy, I think. Slightly before comedy, it wasn't depression. I think these words kind of get conflated.
And depression and what?
Depression and sadness get conflated.
Sure.
And sadness is circumstantial. If you're sad, you're very lucky. Because proper depression, proper actual, okay, you need to take something because something's not right in your brain chemistry.
Yes.
The
worst.
It's the worst. Like when someone tells you they're like, you know, bipolar or something, you go, oh my God, it's a heartbreaker. What can you do?
The weight of it.
It's just, yeah. But if you're sad, if you go, well, I've made some choices. I need to take responsibility for this. And and someone's died and you go, this is my only shot. This is it. I'm working for an oil company. What the fuck am I doing?
You were working for an oil company?
I was working for Shell Oil.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
I was leading, leading someone's life. I don't know what it was. It almost feels like waking up from a dream.
Yeah. What was the process there? Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in a place called Slough, in and around Slough. So Irish immigrant parents, so first generation immigrant to the UK.
Really?
Yeah. So I was like, I was born in England, but I carry an Irish passport. And it's a weird thing. I'm very aware of who I am, but I'm also aware of how I'm perceived. Hmm. And I think there's a weird thing where...
I didn't know what to make of you.
Yeah, if I talk about like, being an immigrant or anxiety, people go, no, you seem fine. No, you seem like a British gentleman that went to a public school. And you go, that isn't me, but I'm aware like how I'm perceived in the world, but also, you know, who I am.
Well, but you have... You know, your stage persona is strong. And I felt when I first met you, I mean, I remember I tried to get you on the show before and I literally thought he's not going to talk about himself in that way, in the way that I talk
I don't think
about.
I was, I think when you asked me very kindly to be on the show before, I wasn't ready for this at all.
Okay.
Not
so
ready.
I wasn't.
No, you weren't wrong. No. It's like that's my stage persona. That's what I do.
Yeah.
And then
the rest is mine.
When you get interviewed. You get interviewed on, I don't know, the Tonight Show or a chat show, it's a very different thing than this. And I'm really enjoying this. I think it's like, it's helping the comedy because you're kind of going, well, I can make a couple of points.
Yeah.
I also think age, 50. I think there's something about the weight of that and how that feels. It makes a bit more sense.
But when I met you, I'm trying to think, it must have been, the first time I met you was probably in Edinburgh, like 2007.
Yeah.
And I was right after my divorce. I was not having a good time. I think I met you with Morgan Murphy.
Yeah, you were having a bad time, I think. Yeah, I think it's fair to say you were having a bad time. It's weird. Yeah. I don't think your success has engendered one bit of envy by anyone else because it's so clear the what you've had to go through to get to this. It's like...
Keep pushing, Jimmy. I keep pushing.
Yeah, but it's... The pathology to be Marc Maron. No one's going, I want some of that.
Yeah.
Whereas
you
see someone on stage, you see Jerry Seinfeld on stage, you go, oh, I wish I could have that.
Yeah.
And it looks so easy.
Yes.
Of course, you don't see the pathology there.
Yeah. But so now you feel more comfortable talking about it. Because maybe when I met you, because that's already, what is that, 16 years ago, were you in the pursuit of well-mindedness at that point?
Yeah, no, I was kind of in the pursuit of it. And I think I'd made the first big shift. Like, I think getting into comedy for me was, at 25, I felt so old. I felt
this
like,
is when you were working at Shell?
Yeah, I felt like life had passed me by. I felt like, what am I doing? I was very well educated.
Were you really like fancy?
Yeah, fancy education. But like that thing of like going, I don't really know what I'm not happy.
Why'd you end up there?
I think it was just like, it was the same reason I ended up at the university. It was like the line of least resistance. I'd never really made a decision. I'd just done the next thing that you do.
But you were kind of, you must have been a worker. You must have had focus. Where'd you go to school?
I went to Cambridge.
That's fancy.
Yeah, fancy.
But no interest in comedy at that time.
No, I mean, I liked it. I like seeing it. But yeah. No interest. No idea that show business could be a job.
What did your folks do?
Mother was a nurse. Oh. And my father was like something in accounts. Don't know. Went to an office.
There's so many people that don't know what their fathers actually do.
No, I mean, I'm literally no idea. It's a weird thing. Like, that's always my, I don't know what you feel about that. That's always my go-to question for comedians. Which of your parents were sick?
Mm.
I didn't realize until years later that I was entirely enmeshed with my mother. I was incredibly close to my mother and was kind of a substitute.
Yeah, I was that
husband, and
I got a little of that from very early on because my dad was, out doing whatever.
Yeah,
he was around, but he was a doctor and he was consumed. He was, you know, out there doing.
Doing stuff.
Yeah, you know, but not present. But yeah, I guess I got enmeshed with her. But both of them were so selfish, I don't really see them as parents as much as people I grew up with that had problems.
You lived with a couple when you were younger.
Yeah, I did, me and my brother.
Nice couple.
No, they weren't that nice. they were difficult, but they meant well. But so wait, so you were meshed with your mother and you feel like, what did that make you? Like, what is your pathology in relation to that? How do you think that affected you?
Well, I think I had a very tough time with women growing up. So I was like, I was a virgin until I was like 26. I was really kind of
wow. That is quite ambitiously.
Yeah, it's very unusual. I mean, I'm kind of embarrassed about it, but it's like you're very kind of shut down. I had loads of friends. I got on very well with people, but it's like it was just a real block. And then, I think that's just because I had a very close relationship with my
mother. What about your dad?
I haven't seen him in 25 years.
How do you carry that?
Very lightly. I think it's like that Al-Anon thing. You detach love.
So that's where you're at with it.
Yeah, you detach with love. It's like, it's a lovely, it's some of these things as well. Like, you know, they sound very dime store wisdom, but there's something really lovely about that other people have been through it.
If you can do it, yeah.
You can kind of go, look, I don't wish any ill. I wish you all the best. I can't have you in my life.
No spite?
No.
No. Oh. What happened? Why is he out?
Nah, I keep on getting sued.
Oh, by him?
Yeah, I implied that he was a narcissist in my book, and yeah. There's like one line about him. I say he's
that's so funny.
And he sued me for calling him a narcissist, which strikes me as fairly narcissistic.
Yeah, my dad did the same thing. I wrote a book and I was honest about him. He's bipolar and narcissistic. But he is part of my story and it upset him. Yeah. And I called him up and he's like, he thought it would get him in trouble somehow. And I said, well, what do you want? You want money? And he goes, yeah. And I go, how much? And he goes, $100,000. I said, I'll give you five. And I did, but I'm okay with him now.
Brennan again gave me the line on narcissism.
Who?
Neil Brennan. Oh. That, you know, when you have a narcissist in your life, they have the disease, you have the symptoms.
That's interesting.
It's like, they don't.
He's done a lot of work on himself, old Neil.
Yeah, he's pretty happy now.
Dude, 10th kid of like an Irish drunk family, not easy.
Yeah.
So you did some Al-Anon, huh?
A little bit, not too much. I mean, I really kind of went to one, read a lot around it, and then was kind of embarrassed about it, but like just read a lot about it.
Was it a boozy thing? Did you grow up in booze?
No, not booze, not just like a, Language of that just made sense to me.
Yeah, no,
and
it makes
was that
sense,
thing
yeah.
when you go, it doesn't have to be your problem; it could be someone else's problem.
Yeah,
I didn't know that existed until you know.
No, me neither.
You're dealing with it for years, and you go, "Oh, it's not Alcoholics Anonymous; it's for the people, the families, and loved ones."
Yeah.
Oh,
that have to. Yeah.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so they don't get dragged in; they don't become the disease.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I didn't. I'm still codependent problems. It's still hard.
Yeah.
It's still hard to detach. And not think, you know, like, but it's so selfish too, that whole thing, codependency. Because
Well,
I mean, if you're actively codependent, you know, you're assuming you have control. And sometimes, you know, that feeling of trying to control somebody else or somebody else's feelings is what you live for. And if that's the case, you know, that's your sickness.
Yeah. Well, it's a weird sickness to have because you're sort of going, I mean, really, when you think about what we do for a living.
Yeah.
You know, you say, well, you know, you can never be in charge of anyone else's happiness. And you often hear that in therapy. And then you go, yeah, but I do that for a living.
Yeah.
Tonight there's 2,000 people. I need to, I'm in charge of their happiness for 2 hours. So actually, it sort of is what I do.
But we figured out.
I know you think it's not important, but who do you think's paying your bill?
We figured out a way around it that we can engage it in a professional way and then not do it a personal way.
Well, I always think that thing about the sick parent thing is the, you know, the thermostat on the room, like learning that early on, that pathology of like learning how to make things okay in the weird atmosphere house when someone gets home and you go, I'm going to make this all right.
I used to do a bit about my mom telling me to, my dad was, when he was depressed, she would say, why don't you go upstairs and make your father laugh? You're the only one who can. Ooh, tough crowd, I tell you.
That's just, how old were you at that point?
I was in my early teens, probably, you know.
Right.
12, 13. Yeah. Well, he's got dementia now, so I'm dealing with a whole new person. And it's entertaining at times.
Right.
I'm all right with him. I kind of let it go, you know.
Yeah. I mean, you feel like you've been through, I mean, the ringer.
I don't know. Like, I think what happened for me, and I don't know if this is what happened for you, is that if you look at the positive qualities of both of them and assess those within you, there's at least something to give them credit for, be grateful for. And then if you identify the negative ones that you also have, then you kind of have to, you know, rewire yourself, but you can't rewire them.
Yeah.
And you can either do that with resentment or not. Like, I'm still aggravated. My father, he doesn't bother me. My mother, they're both very old and they're both still alive. But, you know, after a certain point, even if you're angry, you got to let it go, you know, as long as it's not killing you. Because I got a friend who hasn't talked to his father in decades, and I don't think he's processed it. And I think it hobbled him.
It's weird. I suppose that thing of like, you can't have an easy life and a great character.
Mm.
You know, so you go through it and you go, well, whatever they gave you, whatever gifts you got from that, whoever you became, that thing of like gratitude as, I mean, I don't pray.
Yeah.
But I think having a gratitude practice where you just are always thinking about how grateful you are.
I got to try to do that. You do that?
Yeah. And it's really like not just, oh, well, I'm lucky because I get to do this job. But like, you know, you're healthy and you were born. I think we were born, maybe you and I of the same generation, in the sweet spot.
Yeah.
Of like.
I'm 10 years older.
Yeah, but like in terms of the technology that came through, the idea that, you know, the beginning of this comedy thing, they've been born 100 years ago. I guess we would have been vaudevillians or something, but it's a different life.
Yeah.
The idea that podcast technology came along at this time and became a thing. Like, there's so many factors that you go, wow, it's like all these things aligned
to make this. Yeah, the cosmic timing of me finding the podcast medium. You know, that was a Hail Mary, dude. I mean, I didn't know it would go anywhere. And I wasn't in good shape. And it worked out. You know, I had the right skill set at the right moment. And the timing, cosmic timing just worked out.
Well, then the thing of like what you do on this, but also what you do in stand-up.
Yeah.
It strikes me that the, I don't know how to sort of describe it. I suppose it's a bit like in politics, there's like the Overton window.
Yeah.
Of what you can and what you can't talk about in politics. What is acceptable policy and what isn't at any given time. And
often, does that still hold?
Well, I think it does, because you get like people on the far left or the far right, or yeah, someone like Bernie Sanders runs and he changes it.
Yeah.
Or the libertarians. No, they're never going to get elected.
Right.
But they change things. They start talking about drug legalization in the 70s.
Sure.
And eventually it trickles through and the Democrats go, you know what? That's not a bad idea.
Yeah. And so in some cities, it's turning out not to be a great idea,
but
apparently.
But you change the what can and can't be talked about. Yeah. I think the thing that you sort of did on this, but also in stand-up, is like, okay, so being emotionally that available.
Yeah.
Who was doing that in... It's a different...
It's against our fundamental disposition professionally to do it. So, you know, so yeah.
Yes, we're meant to be hiding from something.
Right, that's right. You know, it's a fundamentally defensive position. The comedic position, yeah. And I didn't know how else to do it, but I appreciate I'll take that as a compliment.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's because when you see the people coming up as well, it's like, if you kind of look at what are people doing?
Mm-hmm.
What are people trying to do? There's a real thing in the UK of like the Edinburgh Festival is like, I know you had a bad experience, but it's kind of great. People going up and doing hours and, putting on a full show as opposed to just like 20 minutes in a club. They're putting on a full show and they're giving of themselves.
Yeah.
And there was kind of a cliche in it for a while. People gave people a hard time for doing dead dad shows, where it was the tragedy show. But actually, it kind of moved the whole thing forward where it's kind of, I don't know, it feels like there's an interesting thing where stand-up meets kind of what we would have called a one-man show.
Yeah, I know.
Like and I've biographical.
I'd done those. I did those years ago in the late 90s. I did a one-person show because it was sort of a thing in the 80s, with performance artists. The format's kind of interesting, but I resented being attached to it, although I did one. I understand why people condescend the one-person show.
I kind of don't get it. Because I sort of think comedy's such a broad church. Well, is it the idea that they go, oh, this isn't a gag every 30 seconds, so it's not for me? Well, watch something else.
No, I get that. I get that. But they're like, I ride this line and in my mind. And I've done one-person shows. I've done serious shit. I'm certainly not always funny here. But there is something about the skill set of comedy as I learned it. You know, and the dues that I paid were specific. There was a way to pay your dues. And, you know, there's part of me that I can't get around that. I honor that. Whether people see that I do or not, I honor that.
Yeah.
Like, if I'm going to work out even the most emotionally wrenching material, I'm going to do it in a club. And I'm going to do it in 15-minute sets. Because if for some reason, and it's starting to fade a little bit, it's important for me that it works there, where people don't know me necessarily. They're at the Comedy Store.
I so buy this. I can see this now in Mike Birbiglia. I see Mike does these beautiful one-man shows,
right.
And they're fantastic, and they're beautiful, and they're like, it's like it's carved out of marble. But then if you know Mike and you hang with Mike, you know he's at the Comedy Cellar working out that 5-minute section and that 5-minute section so that every little bit of it works.
Yeah, his craft is in place, man.
Yeah, because you have to... Well, you don't have to, but you sugaring the pill and going, well, actually, this isn't a TED talk.
Yeah.
People are coming.
Right.
And they need to laugh. And that thing of like the catharsis of saying, well, I live in a buttoned down world and I'm not talking to my family and I'm not talking to my friends and people at the office. And I feel like I'm self-censoring the whole time.
Yeah.
And then you come and see a show where someone opens up and it's that cathartic experience.
But also,
you go and see incredibly edgy jokes and you go, oh, it's cathartic.
That's right.
Yeah.
But you also know with Mike and, you know, with some of the stuff I do as well, that, you know, he's done that work. So no matter how deep it's going to be or potentially emotional, because he's taken it out there and worked it out in the basements, that he has control over it, right? You know, like when I was working out the shit about Lynn dying, like I was doing it in small theaters to sort of move through it, because I knew that I'm not going to have a handle on this. So I'm not going to bring it to a club, but I'll stretch out and maybe cry in front of my audience who knows me and they know what I'm doing until I figure out the where I can find the level, where I can find the comedy in it that's going to be consistent, right?
Right.
So
I was saying that's a very interesting thing of like when a dark sense of humor has a benefit. You know, when is this like... Sort of think it like from a Darwinian evolutionary point of view.
Yeah.
Like, why have a sense of humor? Well, A, it's like pattern recognition and it's linguistic skills. So it's very useful in kind of practical
It's also
terms.
Good at disarming people before they hurt you.
see your childhood for details. but then it's also that thing if you go, it's the idea that you can kind of... you can express something in a dark joke and people can then use it on their worst day.
That's exactly it.
So people that get, everyone's going to deal with disease and death and losing money and losing jobs and terrible things happening and not getting into the school you want.
Right.
And if you don't like dark comedy, if it's not for you and you're easily offended and that, I feel so bad for them. They have to white knuckle the whole of life.
Yeah.
Whereas you go on those days, I often think like the extreme example is Life is Beautiful. The absolute extreme of someone in the camps in World War II having a sense of humor and that
I did a bit about that on my last special. There had to be hilarious people in Auschwitz. I mean, it was full of Jews.
Yeah. How would they? The language of stand up is kind of linked to the it's the Talmud, isn't it? Is it the Talmud is the question and answer?
The Talmud?
Talmud?
Yes.
No, sorry. But that question answer thing is kind of the language of
The language of comedy was Jewish for a while, stand up, yeah.
I think it is. That's the heritage.
But like, well, talking about darkness, you know, because like a lot of times I don't see myself as dark, but I am. I know that. And
well, it's an emotional darkness as well. Like the subject matter, the one liner about something that's dark is very easy to spot.
But I always thought, you know, you struck me as a dark person.
Yeah, but it's a different kind of...
No, but I mean, as a person, you were, as I'm learning now, you were a person that struggled to have some sort of way of getting through life to where you were protecting yourself from something, whether it was anxiety or hopelessness or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the journey, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's still the journey.
Right.
It's still the thing.
Were you religious ever?
Yeah, very. Catholic. So you, like a proper believer.
It was dug in.
Yeah.
You had a hell in your head.
Yes. Yes. I didn't get any of those stories until so much later. I didn't get what because there's two kinds of idiot, right? There's people that believe the fairy stories and there's people that think religion has no purpose.
Yeah.
And you kind of go, well, that's both extremes are kind of...
No, it definitely has a purpose. It definitely has a purpose. I don't fuck with belief as much as I fuck with religion. I understand why people need to believe. I get that. But I do. I'm doing a line on stage now where I'm like, you know, if you believe in God, you'll fucking believe anything. So if you've already opened that door, you got to be pretty vigilant.
that's an interesting point. Yeah, it's what's the great? It's G.K. Chesterton line, isn't it? That where he said, if you don't believe in anything, you'll believe in anything.
Interesting.
Getting what those stories are.
Yeah.
It didn't come to me until sort of much later in life. Like God is the future.
Mm.
So God is meant to be. Sacrifice now for a better tomorrow.
Yeah.
So that thing of like, I didn't get that at all. I didn't get what that was meant to be. I didn't get the
idea.
That
makes no sense to me.
But the idea of like,
yeah, sure.
It's kind of almost like religion is the marshmallow test. Do you want one now or two tomorrow?
No, yeah, I get it. I've never commented about it. But
I never got that.
No.
I never got kind of the bigger picture because it was just...
Well, it's not a bigger picture. It's irrational.
Well, Catholicism is kind of I think the big mistake religion made in my... humble opinion, and I hope the Vatican are listening. I think Vatican II was the mistake because Vatican II was when they said, oh, let's translate this into local languages and everyone can understand it. No, the point of it
keep
was
it
we
coded.
Didn't understand. The point of it was it's a mystery.
Keep it weird with the big robes. I mean, you go to Italy.
And the incense and the whole thing.
There's cathedrals in Italy just filled with dead wizards.
Right.
It's crazy.
There is a mystery out there.
Totally.
And we need something to... Pete Holmes gave me this great line.
Mm.
It's in his book. Mm. He was talking about... And I think it's the roadie from AC/DC said this.
Okay.
He said... it's where I get all my wisdom from. He said, God is the name we give to the blanket. We throw over the mystery to give it shape.
Mm.
I really like... I heard that. I went... Oh, yeah.
And then Angus started Whole Lotta Rosie.
But then whether that's, you know, for some people it's science or religion or whatever.
Sure, whatever.
Their belief thing that they go, well, this is my...
It's transference. Like you need to feel part of something bigger than yourself to give your life definition in a way.
And that can be standing in nature
of course,
or children
of course.
Or
whatever
whatever the thing is for you. But it's an incredibly... important thing.
We, you know, and this is another part of your special where it feels to me that you did, you know, fairly, you know, grounded point of view about religion through a series of jokes that was a larger chunk than I'd seen you do before.
Yeah, it was interesting. It's very interesting doing that in North America, doing that bit about religion, which is, it's good in the UK and it's edgy. You know, it's a bit edgy. Oh, we probably shouldn't have said that. That's a bit meh. But here, it feels like it's there's an excitement in the room.
Oh, yeah.
When you say those things. Sure. Here, there's I kind of hadn't noticed how much more Christian America is.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it's actually when you get out to the... Because I'd spent a lot of time in New York and LA, and I'd not got out to see the other cities. And you get out and you see it and you go, oh, great, okay.
Yeah,
no one seems to mind.
I did this bit. I'm doing this bit now where I tell them. I said, "This joke doesn't work, really, but it's got the logic is tight, and I like doing it." And I say, "I think Christianity at its core is a bit anti-Semitic." And I say because like the core idea of Christianity is the only really good Jew is a dead Jew.
Oh, it's a great joke. it's a great joke.
And it's working now. Those are those grooves you got to make. There's a couple of jokes, and you must know it, where you believe in it. And at first, people are like, "Oh," but if you keep getting more comfortable with it, it eventually will find its. Well, land.
My theory on that is that you go, "I love this line so much," and the audience don't like it, so you change it a little bit, and then they still don't like it, and then you change it another bit, and they still don't like it, and then you change it another bit, and eventually, it's a totally different line,
right,
with a different kind of structure. But you can trace it back in your head to go, I never compromised on nothing.
Yeah.
But ultimately, it's that service thing. The great thing about our job
could be a beat,
is that
one beat.
I sometimes find, I'll find a line through indigestion.
Yeah.
Just like I'll pause in the wrong place because I'm, oh, what?
Yeah.
And it'll get a bigger laugh. And you go, oh, that's interesting. I was doing that wrong the last year.
Yeah, let it wait a beat, whatever. Especially with the joke-to-joke thing. Yeah, you know, that timing is, you know, it's all.
My theory is it's 92 beats a minute. Seems to be the right speed.
Really?
for spoken word.
You've mapped it up?
It seems to be for. I spend a lot of time, like before I recorded the special, I literally put on a playlist of 92 beats a minute and tried to get into that kind of groove. It just seems to be the right speed.
What do you
speed.
Mean a playlist of 92 beats a minute? You mean just
go
a
on
track?
Spotify. Yeah, no. Just on Spotify, you can just do a 92 beats a minute and it'll just play you a bunch of songs that are in that.
Really?
Yeah. It's great.
Where'd you get that number?
I was chatting. My friend Amanda and I are working on a book about stand-up. And we started looking at stand-up, so kind of looking at where their emphasis was.
Yeah.
And she's a jazz musician, by training. And so we're kind of looking at it and going, oh, it does seem that it doesn't matter how fast or slow someone's talking.
Yeah.
They're hitting the beat at about that. And it seems that spoken word-wise and the audience get into a rhythm.
Huh.
And no, she was like that. Directing. She directed my last two live shows.
Maybe you should just listen to a tell for an hour and see what you get.
Yeah. I bet he's doing it though.
I wonder.
But that thing of like going, you're looking at that kind of, when the audience flag, what else is going on? Did the material get weaker after 45 minutes? Or did you get tired and you sped up?
Or did you not fill in the gap in the necessary way?
I think, well, when you're doing, let's say, for my stuff, I could be doing almost exactly the same show, like when I was getting ready for the hour.
Yeah.
So you're doing an hour, and she's coming to see it a couple of times.
Yeah.
And you go, well, it didn't work as well that night. What happened? Well, you sped up.
That's interesting.
You sped up. You didn't. So what was the other thing going on that wasn't the lines, wasn't the audience?
No, it's definitely
the frequency of the line.
It's very meticulous. And it's so, it's interesting. You're so conscious of it.
Well, the other thing I'm going through that I'd never really thought to do before was going through for joke types and just taking shit out.
Oh, you got to do that. Too many. You don't want to repeat yourself.
Well, yeah, but it's amazing actually when I watch something, if I watch a stand-up, and it could be a stand-up I really like, and you go, it's a bit boring. Yeah. Oh, they're just doing pullback reveals again and again.
Yeah.
They everything's a hook. Everything's a hook. Everything's a hook. They need a jab.
But it's funny about rhythm though, because like a tell will even make noises to keep his rhythm going.
I mean, it's
he'll do a joke, be like, hey, bah, 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 and then he'll just go, then he knows his rhythm so well that sometimes he'll just make noises.
If you noticed as well, sometimes if he'll get a laugh and the line, he won't have got the line right.
Yeah, yeah. Because his timing is so fucking solid.
It's like I've Rickles. Had that before where I've delivered a punchline from the wrong joke. Like two shows in a night.
But the timing was already.
But the timing was so perfect. Yeah. They went, okay. And
Rickles made sense half the time. It was all timing. I mean, he would say things that made no sense at all.
I played Vegas for the first time the other night, and I was really like thinking about Don Rickles a lot. And kind of thinking that heritage thing of like, my God.
Also in this new special, you do some extensive crowd work that goes places. You give a young man a life lesson.
I thought that was that was a very, I kind of wrote that in the pandemic. And it was that thing of someone said, oh, well, it's obvious. you know, consent is obvious. Mm. I think, yeah, it is to all of us,
yeah.
But to 17-year-old boys,
yeah.
I think that thing of like going, I'm just going to state the obvious here. I'll make it as funny as I can.
Yeah, but I like
but
this
it's
stuff.
Kind of interesting of going, I'm not wrong about anything in that. It's just, it's a nice thing to hear it from, and they'll take it from me.
Right. Well, what's interesting about you is that, you know, because I, you know, I put you in a place where you have a defined stage persona that does a thing. And you have your thing, and it's all edgy jokes. It's all, you know, shocking jokes that are, you know, beautifully written. But like in this special, like I was surprised because like I back in the day, I didn't know if we would be able to have a conversation necessarily, only because I didn't know if you ever got out from under that thing that you do. But, you know, you have opinions and I thought, you know, we all had our vax jokes, you know, at the time. And I thought your vax joke, you know, engaging the audience in the way you did was a very clever way to posit the idea. Because I did something, not the same, but similar about like, you know, how many people with polio do we have? I mean, the idea of it, you know, in conversation with a guy who admits to being an anti-vaxxer, the position is a good position.
Yeah, because I mean, it's slightly a straw man that I'm setting up in the gag. Because it is that thing where I'm sort of going, I'm taking anti-COVID vaccine people and the anti-vax lunatics that don't like any vaccines.
Of course. Well,
which is, it's a sleight of hand there where it's a bit unfair on the guy in the audience. I know those people get upset.
I don't know if it's unfair because, you know, whatever differentiation they're making between vaccines is not really the issue. The issue is that, you know, we believe science at one point in time was in the benefit of public safety.
Yeah.
And when it became a wedge issue, it became the government is using science to kill us.
Right.
So it's a different, it's a point of view thing. So it's not really that much of a straw man.
Yeah. Well, you know, I like to give them an out because the guys with the COVID thing, I can go, okay, well, that was a weird, I think we can all agree, no one handled that great.
No one handled any of it great.
It was a very tough time. But the idea of, again, kind of doubling down on that, because they did one in the last one that upset them. So I thought, oh, I'll do another one.
Yeah. Oh, they upset the anti-vaxxers. Yeah. Well, this one, you engage somebody and there was a logic to it that they can't deny. All they could say is like, well, these vaccines are different and they're doing this other thing.
Yeah. But it's again, it goes back to gratitude. It goes back to kind of going, oh, you know, these big pharmaceutical companies, they're out to get us. And you go, yeah, but as opposed to what?
Right.
Wait, do you remember
leeches?
Do you remember Spanish flu?
Yeah,
that was a bad business, wasn't it?
Yeah.
No, we didn't have any vaccines for that. Thank God. Oh. Everybody died. It's like no one's celebrating that fact. No one's going, oh yeah, young men they're dying in. Of course, the reason it's called Spanish flu as well is because there was a war on.
Yeah, but there's a belief system at hand now that is, you know, kind of supplement driven and spite driven and false information driven, where people just think that all you got to do is man up.
Yeah, it's the walk it off.
Yeah,
walk it off. It is that weird thing as well, where you go, it's people that don't want institutions. They don't want.
That's right. It's the same.
No, what you need is better institutions.
That's right.
You can't not have them. They've just got to be good.
Let me ask you about this situation, though. You know, because you know you're a person that has been taken to task publicly over jokes, right? Yeah. And in Britain, and they were specific jokes about, I'm not even sure what.
We could do a list. There's loads.
Right. But there was not, at the time when some of it happened, there was no cancel culture per se. There was just pushback, right?
Well, there's a huge difference between cancel culture and criticism.
Right.
And criticism is absolutely fair game. I'm not for everyone. Right. You know, I say in the special, jokes are like magnets. They attract some people and they repel some people. And that's kind of okay. And some people don't like it. And that's fine. The cancellation thing, when someone goes, "What? Not only did I not like it, I don't think he should be allowed to say that."
But the grassroots, mob mentality of social media platforms to deny people work, to get people pushed out of the gig.
Yeah. It strikes me as we're in quite an interesting position now in terms of podcasting and stand-up comedy, where you go, are we the only ones that are cancel-proof? Because there's no shareholders.
That's right.
There's no one to kind of go,
right.
Oh, well, you know, you can't say that.
Now people can build their own show business. So you're not beholden to a corporate show business entity.
Yeah, and the only question you have to ask yourself when you get canceled is, who are you?
Right. Did you mean to say that?
Did you misspeak?
That's right. If you're going to say something, can you bear the weight of the consequence. Is it worth it?
There's no freedom of consequence. And is it worth it? I think that thing of is it worth it is very important as well, because how big a laugh something gets does matter. Sometimes you write something, I write really edgy jokes, and it kind of gets, it's okay. It's not worth it.
Right.
You've gone too far there. There's not enough.
That's right.
That's coming back. And you go, no, this really has to be worth it, because this is a sensitive topic. I want to talk about it. I want to air it. I want people to talk about it.
Or take the air out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's got to be funny enough. It's got to be so funny if it's going to be that dark.
But I thought that thing you said about, you know, and a lot of people, you know, of the big issue is that, you know, this cancel culture has done wonders for people's career who stand up against whether it's real or it's not. The idea that there's a bunch of comics that are like, I'm anti-woke. What does that even mean? You know, if that's your whole angle, it's sort of a new hook.
But if you step back and you go, okay, let's look at the numbers.
Sure.
Let's look at the metrics here. Who's selling tickets, right, comedy-wise?
Right.
Who's being canceled? No one. It's like, that's right. What are you talking about?
But people like to say it because it's actually a good brand for certain people, for a certain audience.
I think it's a very good brand. But
sure.
That thing of like going, it's not for everyone. And being canceled is kind of it's a good experience.
Yeah.
It's good in lots of ways. It's a good filter.
Yeah.
It's a good filter on you.
How so?
Well, it's a good filter on friends.
Yeah. Okay.
Who are your friends? Who's actually a bit gleeful that this has happened to you? Who's throwing you under the bus? Who's making a comment about you? Who's tweeting something? And who's, okay.
About your jokes.
About the jokes.
Yeah.
So it's that thing of you go, I mean, you have to right size it as well when it happens. You have to say, look, I told a joke and some people didn't like it. That's what's happened.
But your joke in the special is really very concise and very funny. The one about, how did you phrase it when you got,
give me the subject matter. What's the?
It's about being canceled, and he says, "Oh, so you admit that you know that?
Oh, is that? I say things that don't happen." So the next time I get canceled, it's my plan for the next time, which will be directly after this. It'll be so the next time I get canceled, I'm going to say, "I'm sorry," and the people that I've upset will say, "You don't really mean that apology," and I'll say, "So you're saying I could say something and not mean it? Now you're getting it." It's
very good.
But it is that thing where you kind of go, yeah, I mean...
It's a joke.
These are all jokes. I mean, the idea in my last special, because anti-vax people did get upset with me, and you go, well, you think I told 75 jokes, took a break to make a serious point about vaccines, and then told, which everyone laughed at, weirdly, and then told 75 more jokes? That seems like an odd way to get a point
across. Yeah, but there was also the other point where you say that some of these people don't understand jokes.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
On both sides.
Well, but I think sometimes it's the idea that journalists do kind of a bad faith article about, he made this statement.
Right.
And you go, no, I didn't make a statement. I made a joke. And that's a very different thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, but you are sensitive to certain things, like language changes. And even the way you handle pronouns, there was an empathy to it. There are people that are literally like, fuck that. Yeah. And your bit... You know, even being an edgy comic was a bit about tolerance.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I mean, listen, I think that thing about the idea of it being a sacred cow that you can't talk about strikes me as ridiculous. But also, like, be a human being. Like,
right.
It's just a joke. It's a piece of wordplay. And everyone can laugh together.
Yeah.
That unifies us. We're all in this together.
Yeah. So I think as long as it's not mean-spirited and you're holding some line.
But intention is very important as
it's
well.
It's all of it.
If you're making... a point about something. I sometimes don't know what people are doing on stage when they're making a very serious point about something. You go, well, this might be the wrong medium. we're at the chuckle hut.
Yeah. Neil's got a whole bit about, you know, why are they coming to the clowns as the moral arbiters of.
Yeah,
of,
it's funny.
It is.
On the new one. Yeah. Crazy good.
Yeah. Good talking. I know you got other things to do.
No. I mean, this is fantastic.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. But I liked the special and I thought, it did seem like, as you talked about earlier, that you are doing, you know, longer pieces about things, you know, and it's...
I'm trying to get better. I'm just trying to get better. I think that thing as well, if you go, how do you make this feel new after 25 years?
But better is... But I think that you're not giving yourself enough credit. That, you know, better is one thing, but, you know, evolving a point of view is a real thing. You know, just being a guy who tells a certain type of joke... You know, that's a performance, right? That's a character. But to engage a point of view with some consistency is, that's personal growth. So you are getting better as a person.
Yeah. Wow. I'm writing the new one now. There's a big chunk on mental health, which I think is quite interesting.
I watched Neil's the other night, and you know, I'm doing a bit about personal trauma that I think makes the same point. But I'm a guy who has to come from my experience, so it's not going to be like I'm not, you know, pontificating about anything. But what's your angle?
My angle is the bit is about how I think men need therapy. Every man in the room should be seeing a therapist once a week.
Sure.
Women don't need therapy. Women have got friends to talk to. Men have got friends. Sure, we've got friends.
Right.
But not to talk to. Men will do pretty much anything to avoid talking to their friends.
Yeah.
And that's the jumping off point.
Uh-huh.
And then it gets into the whole thing of like the... And then I get to kind of... I think I'm funny enough in that bit. I think it's working quite well.
Yeah.
That I think I have permission to make a point about suicide.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, it's a thing that's affected so many people. And it's often seen as a thing that stands alone, not a symptom of a mental health crisis. And so it's just that simple line, the permanent solution to a temporary problem.
I like that idea. Because like Neil's sort of poking fun at the sort of branding of trauma.
The bit about World War II is just, it's phenomenal.
That's
funny. Crazy good.
Yeah,
it's so good.
Yeah, that's funny. But it is, in a comedic way, a bit insensitive. You know, it's not like those guys came home, they didn't talk about it, and they just went about their lives in a healthy way. Half of them drank themselves to death, you know, destroyed their families, created legacies of fucking nightmares for generations of people.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they didn't talk about it.
You ever seen that documentary by Adam Curtis, The Mayfair Set?
No, I love him, though. Do you know him?
No, I've never met him, but I mean, he's an absolute... I mean,
holy shit.
So those documentaries...
What a fucking genius.
So there's like, The Mayfair Set's really worth watching. It's about these guys came back from World War II, totally traumatized. They were in the gambling dens of Mayfair and they were hanging out and they invented corporate raiding. So they're sitting around and they invented, like they were just kind of trying to come up with stuff to do to keep them occupied, drinking huge amounts, gambling huge amounts.
Yeah.
And the first ever corporate raid was it's an orchard in the North of London. It was an orchard owned by a family. Some financial advisor went, oh, you should sell the shares on the stock market. That'll make you a few quid. So the guys bought 51%. They didn't realize it could be taken from them.
Yeah.
And then they built houses, chopped all the trees down, built houses, made a fortune, and then just repeat and repeat and repeat. And kind of modern finance was built from these incredibly traumatized
men. And not a great thing.
No. No. A pretty bad.
That's the legacy of trauma. That's interesting. I was going to tell you before we go, though.
I think Neil's got he's got the trauma wings. I think he's allowed to poke fun at trauma.
No, definitely. He's a guy who's poking fun at trauma, but he's living trauma.
Yeah.
He's like trauma personified.
I know. I'm not meant to be promoting someone else's special, but Crazy Good is crazy good.
It's is good, yeah. I'm going to talk to him, I think, later this week, but about suicide, because I've made plenty of jokes about suicide. But did you know that one of the arguments for gun control is based on the British natural gas? That there was the idea, I read an article about this. There was a period, I don't know if it was in the 50s or what, there was a time in Britain where the gas that they were using for the stoves in Britain was highly toxic. And if you turned the gas on, stuck your head in the oven, you'd be dead in a couple minutes.
Yeah, this is Sylvia Plath?
Maybe, but they changed the gas. And the one they changed it to was a lot less toxic. So the suicide rates went down dramatically. So if you don't have the gun in the house, you're not going to decide to do that.
Yeah, it's that moment.
Right.
It's a moment because you don't want to feel that feeling. You don't want to not feel anything ever again.
Yeah.
It's the perspective thing.
Right.
It's like it's that. So if you got to keep
if your head's in the oven and it's not happening quickly, you're gonna cough and rethink it.
I think Sylvia Plath nearly killed the guy in the flat downstairs. It's in Primrose Hill, the house.
Oh, really?
Because it had wooden floorboards.
Okay.
And the gas.
It must
leaked
have been that toxic.
Upstairs.
Super
toxic. Well, they had to put smell in it as well. They had to put the smell of gas in the gas.
Because
it wasn't in there for a long time. You didn't know.
Yeah. Well,
that's
an
artificial smell.
I just thought that was interesting. That if you have time to rethink it, you might rethink it.
Yeah.
Probably.
I had an idea of the gun control. I had an idea for gun control. I don't think it's a bit, but it's an idea.
Yeah.
I think gun clubs.
Sure.
Okay. So you set up gun clubs.
They have them.
They're
called paramilitary.
But no. But everyone that wants a gun, that's fine. You have to join up with 1,000 other guys.
Yeah.
And you can be in a gun club.
Yeah.
And then there's collective responsibility.
Which means what?
If there's a crime committed with your gun or something bad happens with your gun, then everyone in the group gets fined. And so you have to check up on each other. So you go, it's kind of what the original bit, I think, is. If you read the thing in the Constitution, it strikes me that that's kind of in the spirit of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that maybe you should hang out in America a little longer.
Do you think I might get shot?
No, I'm just saying that these gun clubs, they exist, but they have an agenda, and it's not to monitor each other.
Yeah, but if there was a... Because they brought it in Australia, right?
Mm.
I kind of think that thing of the future is here, but it's not evenly distributed. There's great ideas around the world.
Yeah.
Just, I don't think the Australians mind if you take it, but they changed their gun laws and they said, right, if your gun is involved in a crime, you don't go to prison for that crime.
Yeah.
But you get massive fines for your gun going missing.
So it's about gun responsibility.
And that collective responsibility of going, and if people don't like my idea, what are they going to do? Band together and protest? They've already formed the club. They're halfway there.
Yeah, I don't know. I appreciate the thing.
I'm trying to help. I'm trying to help while I'm here.
Yeah, and maybe that'll do it. Maybe this will be the moment. Good talking to you, Jimmy.
A pleasure. Take care.
There you go. Definitely, that moved at a pretty fast clip. Jimmy's Netflix special, Jimmy Carr, Natural Born Killer, starts streaming tomorrow. Hang out for a second, folks. Okay, look, for Full Marin listeners, this week we have a bonus episode all about the show that most directly made way for WTF, Break Room Live, a live streaming show with me and Sam Cedar. The idea for Break Room, I don't know who came up with...
No, I know exactly how it happened. We had a day where we couldn't use that studio.
Right.
And we said, well, let's just shoot today's show in the kitchen, right? Let's go in there. And that one day was better than any of the other days we had done because you were interacting with staff members as they came in to make their lunch. And and so we knew it when the day was done. We're like, that's the show.
Right.
Like the dynamic that went on in there today, that's the show. So we went and pitched that. We should do this in the break room. And it required a complete overhaul. We had to redo the website. We had to, you know, change everything that we had structured promotionally for this thing being called Marin V. Cedar. Now it was called Break Room Live. And, but it was actually probably easier as a technical undertaking because all they had to do was run some cables from next door to the break room. That was it. We picked up and packed out every day.
Yeah, I thought it was a brilliant idea. And the funny thing is that this show would be just par for the course now.
Yes.
We could do it in the middle of the day and it would do fine. It would get good numbers.
Yeah, nowadays lots of people do these things on YouTube every single day.
To get that episode plus all the bonus episodes we do for Full Marin subscribers, go to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. And just a reminder before we go, this podcast is hosted by Acast. Guitar time. lives. Monkey and LaFonda, cat angels everywhere.